are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
I was thinking about what to do next, and I'm very interested in education. I'm a geek with three school-age kids, but no other qualifications in education. I mean, I've been to school, but that's about the extent of it.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Timo Hane, data scientist and founder of the education data analytics firm SchoolDash. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are the importance of fun in the classroom, how data and education can work together, and recognizing the need to slow down even when you enjoy what you do.
Hi Timo, could you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them who you are, what you do?
Hi Ross, yeah, I'm Timo Hane. I'm the founder of SchoolDash, which is an education data analytics firm.
And how did you get into SchoolDash? So in fact, let me give you some help there with that vague question. Can we go back to your own childhood? Tell us briefly about your education history.
Yeah, so I grew up in Hampshire. I went to predominantly state schools. I went to the local primary school, the local non-selective comprehensive school, but then ended up in, I did my A-levels in Scotland at Gordonston, which is a boarding school, a public boarding school. I got a scholarship there. My father, who's Scottish, had actually attended that school back in the day, and hence his interest in sending me there. So I've had a mixed education, I suppose, in that sense, in that I went to relatively good state schools, but non-selective state schools, and then ended up at a very posh boarding school.
What are your memories of any teachers that stand out in your childhood?
So I loved science, particularly biology. At university, I went on to study biochemistry and then did a doctorate in neurophysiology. So I had some very influential biology teachers. One at my secondary school, Mr. Wilbraham, who is a real character, extremely amusing. And actually at Gordonston as well, Dr. Pickering, who was the head of biology when I arrived there, was extremely influential on me. He was a biochemist, actually.
And I'm quite fascinated in the hallmarks of effective teachers rather than teaching. So what were the qualities of what they did that stood out for you?
So for me, they made it entertaining. I think they, but in very different ways. So my secondary school teacher was a bit of a jester. He was like always very amusing. He'd love puns and he'd love to make kind of little jokes here and there. And so we found him incredibly amusing. I found the underlying subject intrinsically interesting. So I think there was something just innate with me that kind of liked biology for whatever reason. But they just made it fun. It didn't feel stressful. It felt like we were learning, but it was, he would never take himself too seriously. I think when I went and did A-level biology, my teacher had a very different personality. But again, he was always going above and beyond kind of what we just needed to learn for the test. I had a particular passion for marine biology. I loved sort of coral. I used to keep like a marine fish tank at home.
Right.
And I remember having talks with both of my biology teachers at O-level and at A-level, actually, around, marine biology, around fish, around sea life generally. And I think, in different ways, both of them brought out, they used my, slightly perverse interest in that particular area of biology to bring out my interest in the subject as a whole.
Tell me more about your research at Oxford. What did you get into?
Yeah, so I worked on the way that nerve cells communicate with one another, and particularly the way that synapses, which are the connections between nerve cells, change when memories are formed. So I was working way down at the cellular level, right? So I can't tell you much about how to develop a better memory, for example. But a key part of our theories of the way the brain works is that we remember things in large part because the strengths of connections between our nerve cells change, and that results in different behavior, and that's the way that memories are laid down and also erased. And I worked on the mechanism for how does that happen and under what conditions, and are we able to control it? And ultimately, I wasn't working on this question directly, but ultimately, are there things we can do to help improve memory, either in memory impaired like people with dementia, or even in otherwise healthy people? Are there things we can do to improve memory by fiddling with that? Now, I wasn't working on that directly, but the kind of research I was doing was basic, but kind of leads on to that kind of question.
Are there any tips you could give for teachers to help their kids remember things better?
Right, so that's where, because I'm not a psychologist, that's where I'm less well-equipped. But there are really, actually well-developed theories of memory and learning that I think are, that are actually well-understood and not that complicated, right? So things like spaced repetition, things like you remember things when you're kind of emotionally engaged, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on this, but, you know, and I think at the risk of stating the obvious, mm-hmm. I think making sure that people are alert and emotionally engaged in some way, they're excited about something, they find something amusing, like those things are easy to remember. Spaced repetition is also incredibly important. And something I hang out a lot in technology circles. This is something that technologists are very interested in. I even know some technologists that have created their own software in order to help them remember things that automatically delivers stuff to their phone, you know, in a spaced repetition way. So, you know, you review things the next day and then you review them the next week and then you review them the next month. And that stuff can be incredibly effective. But I won't pretend to be a world expert.
Yeah, okay. tell me more about School Dash, how it came to be. In fact, before that, we talked earlier about, before we came online, your life for data science.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us briefly about that and then how that came into School Dash.
Yeah, so I was originally a scientist rather than a data scientist, a neurophysiologist. But I worked in business for many years in academic publishing. And I latterly, I set up, between 2010 2015, I set up a data and software business serving the research community, the scientific and other research communities, so universities and other research centres around the world. So it was a business called Digital Science. It grew out of a company called Nature Publishing Group, which is a big scientific publisher where I used to work. And it was providing data and software services for researchers and universities around the world. And when I moved on from that role, I'd sort of built up that business and wanted to do something different. I was thinking about what to do next, and I'm very interested in education. I'm a geek with three school-age kids, but no other qualifications in education. I mean, I've been to school, but that's about the extent of it. But I was very interested in setting up a data and software business in an area that I care passionately about, like research, but not research, because I'd done that. And funnily enough, I recently, at that time, worked on a data project for the Board of Governors at our local primary school, helping them understand some of the kind of DfE data more effectively, and helping them think through things like benchmarking, effective benchmarking of their school. And this was around 2014, and I became aware then of just how much data are available. Particularly since 2010, the government's been pumping out data, especially about schools in England, but usually in a fairly raw form, so it's not that easy to kind of interpret it without quite a bit of effort. But as I was digging into this data, partly for this data project for our local primary school, it became apparent to me just how much you can learn from it. As, you know, at that time, just as a punter, right, as a parent and as a member of society. And I was just fascinated by it. So School Dash really came from my observation that there's loads of data out there and you can discover really interesting things from it if you analyse it and present it in the right way. And it seemed to me while some people were doing that, perhaps not enough people were doing it well enough, or maybe I could do something to help.
And then... So we've had a little look through School Dash. Now I'm familiar with the blog and the website for a few years now. When did you start it? 2000 and...
So 2015. Okay. Good. September 2015 was when the website originally launched. And then, you know, it was very much an experiment. It would be hard to describe it as you know, an initiative, let alone a business, right? And you know, that ended up picking up in the following weeks, ended up picking up some press interest, and we ended up doing a lot of media and so forth.
When I first started to use it as a school leader, it was incredibly valuable, and you know, being time poor and things like that. What would be your top tip for school leaders who are not aware of School Dash or are already using it? Any recommendations? What best to get out of it?
Yeah, so I mean, I think you know, if you're interested in general educational trends, have a look at our blog. So go to schooldash.com, click on the blog link at the top of the page, and have a look at some of the analyses we've done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've done everything from, you know, we've done recent stuff on pupil well-being. We've done things on socioeconomic and ethnic segregation in schools. Mm-hmm. We've done things on, you know, academisation, okay. on, you know, all of those kinds of things. So I think have a look at, you know, what we've got there in the different posts. And, you know, you can, in many of them, we go into kind of exquisite detail. So you can do a fairly deep dive. And we also try to provide a summary up top if you just want to know
what the knowledge is power. So imagine you've looked at incredible sources of data in great depth. What do you now know? Or what's been the most interesting research that you've disclosed?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the two questions. One, what have you discovered? But two, what would you now like to see change in education as a result of your analysis?
Yeah, so I think some of the things that we've quote-unquote uncovered are fairly well known, at least in education circles, but perhaps weren't known more widely, and some of them are perhaps more surprising and less well known. I mean, so I can only give you a few examples because there's like dozens and dozens that I could mention, but one of the first things that was very evident was the regional disparities in England particularly, because that's where we've done a lot of our analysis. Like, so London being a real outlier in the education system in this country, mm-hmm. In all sorts of different ways, mostly in good ways. Other regional disparities, you know, the kind of north-south divide and disparities by local affluence and poverty. Mm-hmm. But there's other things that I think are... I mean, something related to that that we've published on a couple of times now that I think, you know, people are less aware of is if you look at the relationship, for example, between poverty and attainment, clearly there's a negative relationship. The poorer the area or the poorer the school, the poorer the people, the more likely they are to underperform compared mm-hmm. to the national norm. But one thing that's relatively well known is London has not broken that connection, but it's certainly reduced it. Right? If you look at the slope of that line, as it were, between poverty and attainment, it's much shallower in London than it is in other parts of the country. So mm-hmm. there's all kinds of debates about how and why, mm-hmm. but that's a hugely interesting and important fact. Another aspect, though, that I think is less well understood is that slope kind of disappears during primary school. So if you test kids at age 7 and you look at the relationship with poverty, it's very strong at age 7. By age 11, it's essentially disappeared. So primary schools actually do, for whatever reason, nationally, it's not just London, do a really good job, it seems, in closing that attainment gap. But then you test again at 16 at GCSE and, you know, it's come back, right? So for me, that's one of the kind of interesting things that's perhaps underappreciated. And even as I go to, you know, speak with specialists in the area, it seems to me that's an underappreciated, underinvestigated phenomenon.
So is the one thing you'd like to see, knowing all the things you've looked at so far, what's the kind of key thing that keeps coming back to you that you'd like to see change in the system?
Well, so the big top level thing is that to a first approximation, all the negative indicators tend to co-occur and all the positive indicators tend to co-occur. So that said, obviously every school has things it's doing better that, you know, rather than worse, and every school has things it can work on, however good it is. But when you look at negative indicators, right, generally negative indicators, underperformance, high staff sickness, high pupil absence, you know, high levels of deprivation, you know, low levels of parental engagement, those kinds of things, they tend to all co-occur, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think we should be surprised by that, but I think as I look at the data from all sorts of different angles, it comes out again and again and again, right? That, you know, low Ofsted ratings, high staff sickness, low attainment, all of those kinds of high poverty all correlate, mm-hmm. And very strongly. And that means, in effect, we have this sort of bifurcated education system, right? Which means you've got schools that are doing well and they feed off that success, and schools that are struggling, and as a result, they struggle even more over time. And you get a virtuous, a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think anyone should be particularly surprised that that's the case. I just think the strength of those effects is surprising when you look at the data, and the difficulty in undoing the vicious cycle
trying to fix it
is evident. Yeah.
So your work is varied, you know, you're with EdTech, sometimes with government, sometimes with various organisations and newspapers. So describe maybe a typical week, if that's possible, what you do. You know, you're probably coding quite a lot.
A podcast interview, podcast. You know, whatever, yeah. It's hard to describe a typical week, but it would normally be a mixture of doing commission projects mm-hmm. for the kinds of organisations you're talking about, anything from like big educational publishers to news organisations to, you know, policy makers or, you know, government organisations or whatever. So doing that kind of commissioned research or joint research with mm-hmm. organisations, that's probably half my time, I would say. Mm-hmm. I should point out there are other people that help me with School Dash, but on the analysis and the client-facing side, it's just me. I do that work. I have people that deal with press relations and other sort of business aspects, but the technical and client-facing work is me. So that's probably about half my time. Mm. The other half is a combination of analyses that we think are interesting that we want to put out on our mm-hmm. blog usually, and then we'll work with the media also to put the word out. Just, you know, if we come across a new data set we think is cool and interesting, or we just have an idea, or someone has suggested, we get suggestions sent in by blog readers, you know, can you look into this for us? Which we try and act on when we can. meeting people. I spend a lot of time going around and meeting people. So that's existing clients, but potential clients, but also just people who are doing interesting stuff in education. Mm-hmm. So edtech companies. I've worked in the startup space for many, many years in different capacities. And so I really like meeting entrepreneurs. I spend a lot of time with edtech companies.
You also mentioned earlier that you're a governor and you're a full-time dad with three daughters, bilingual Japanese, which is interesting as well. How has School Dash influenced your life as a father and as a chair of government?
So I'm actually not a school governor, but I have worked with governing bodies of our local schools, and you know, have provided for the support for various either local schools or elsewhere. So I've worked with governing bodies, but I am father of three school-age kids. How has it affected it? It's interesting. I'm not sure it's affected me as a father terribly much. I think it's almost the other way around. It's like being a father has probably affected the way I look at the data and think about it. Mm. I hope it's grounded me a little bit more reality. One mm-hmm. of the dangers for someone like me is I'm a data geek and I don't work in a school. I've never worked in a school. And one of the dangers is you look at the data and you slightly lose touch with reality about, you know, you see a correlation, you think, oh, this is important or mm-hmm. it's interesting or it means X, Y, or Z. And actually you've misunderstood what's going on the ground, mm-hmm. right? So in a way it's more like what my kids have taught me about what might be going on. So I talk, right, probably as a result of doing School Dash, I talk with my kids a lot more about what happens in school.
Right. Right?
They're my kind of channel into what's actually happening. And not that their schools are necessarily typical, but yeah. So I think it's sort of that way around in some ways.
I have to also mention, we talked offline that you had a heart attack when you were 45.
Mm.
That event in your life, a huge impact. How has it changed or shaped your workload well-being?
Yeah, so that, I mean, indirectly, that was the reason I set up School Dash, because I had a heart attack. I had a great job. It was very demanding, but very fulfilling. But I knew that I had to stop doing it if I was going to kind of be around for much longer. Mm. So one of the things that involved was a lot of international travel. So mm-hmm. School Dash doesn't involve so much of that now, much, much less. I travel overseas just a few times a year now. Which really helps, and so that was by design.
Mm-hmm.
I also, because it's my own business, there are certainly stresses and strains involved in that, but I'm more autonomous, so there's a good, different kind of stress, which
yeah.
is perhaps as good as a rest, I don't know. I try and get work-life balance, but to be honest, I work as hard as I ever have.
Mm. In different
but, way. But I have flexibility, which means I can go for a run, I can walk my daughter into school,
right.
I can, you know, and then I can work late into the evening, right, as opposed to having to do things exactly when, mm-hmm. you know, my boss tells me I have to do it. So what I try and do is build my work around my life as opposed to try and build the rest of my life around my work. It doesn't mean less work, it just means hopefully being able to get
work
a slightly
a different
balance. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to fire loads of random questions at you, so I want you to respond as quick
as possible.
This is
intimidating.
Yeah,
okay.
What's your favourite piece of software?
Oh, blimey. I would say D3, which you may not have heard of. So
no.
D3 is a software library that you can use in web browsers for doing interactive graphics.
Okay.
So I love it.
Top tip for computer science teachers in secondary schools? What you'd like them to teach kids, perhaps?
There's so many really fun projects. Don't think too much about the technology. Think about what you can do with it. And the knowledge of, and excitement about the technology will take care of itself. There's so many fun and interesting things you can do.
Uh-huh.
I did a face recognition app with my daughter, who was then about 12, on a yeah. Raspberry Pi, and it was really cool, and we both really enjoyed it. And she learned more about the technology as a result of... She decided that's what we were going to do. She wanted
right.
a parent alarm for her bedroom that could recognise faces and recognise
yeah.
when it was someone who wasn't her coming
right,
to her bedroom.
Right.
right? And it was immense fun. So I'm not a professional teacher,
okay.
but that's my experience.
What book are you reading at the moment?
So I am currently reading a science fiction book, science fiction-ish thriller, written by a friend of mine called Tom Chatfield, who gave me a copy, and I'm really enjoying it. So,
right, great.
Yeah.
When you're on in the flow, on in your jogging, where's your favourite run? How long can you run for?
So I live in East Finchley, in North London. I usually run around sort of Hampstead Heath Extension in that area, which is
yeah.
sort of nice, plush, affluent area. well lit and, you know, quite leafy. I run, it's about 9 or 10K course. I do that usually on a Sunday morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you weren't a data geek or a data scientist, what would be your dream job?
I'd love to be a writer. I think one day, maybe when I pack it all in and I've got enough money in the bank, I'd go away and I've written several unpublished books because I've been writing kind of all my life. Okay. So I like writing, fiction or non-fiction.
You talked about marine life earlier. Have you ever been diving and where?
So I went very briefly scuba diving in Thailand when my wife and I went on holiday there many, many, many years ago. Uh-huh. But as a kid, my father was an airline pilot. We used to travel all around the world as a result. Very lucky. Went to places like Mauritius and Hawaii, and I spent endless hours and days snorkeling around the coral reefs there.
Top tip for someone visiting Japan? Tokyo, at least?
Yeah. If you're in Tokyo and it's a really, really, really clear day, take a day trip to Mount Fuji. It's absolutely amazing. But you have to do it on a clear day, you just won't see anything.
Right. Finally, who would you recommend I interview next and why?
Oh, if you haven't already interviewed her, Rose Luckin, who's a professor at UCL.
I know Rose, yeah.
Okay,
I'll get in touch with Rose.
She's a hard lady to get hold of.
And why?
So she's just super interesting. She's got a very interesting background in sort of education and technology.
Yeah.
And I think she's got really lots of really smart ideas about the potential of AI in education, which I think is still replete with opportunity, but also replete with snake oil salesmen at this point in its development.
Well, I know Rose. I've met her once or twice, and Priya Lakhani, you might have heard, who does a lot of AI century tech.
Yep.
Okay, where can listeners find out more about you online? Websites, blogs, tweets, those types of things?
So go to schooldash.com. That's where all our School Dash stuff is. There's also at School Dash on Twitter. I used to tweet as Timo Hane, but I no longer tweet.
I've seen that.
it's fine.
So you tweet as School Dash.
There is a Wikipedia page about me, but latterly it's been edited mostly by my daughter and her friends, I believe. And I've never read it since it was originally set up many years ago. So I don't know what it says, and I've no idea if it's accurate.
Well, I'll take a look. Right, Tim, it's been a pleasure to meet you. You've actually blown my mind with a lot of data, particularly Ofsted and social mobility. So I'm looking forward to exploring that over the next few years. It's been great to meet you.
Thanks, Ross. And, likewise, a pleasure.
We'll keep in touch. And everyone out there listening, look at school-dash.com.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.